Economic numbers for the second quarter show the sharpest drop-off in modern history, the economy shrinking by 32.9%.
We've never seen anything quite like it.
Could the third quarter be any better?
I'm David Green with Steve Inskeep, and this is Up First from NPR News. Oregon's governor says federal agents have agreed to step back. They'll reduce their presence on streets where they've been confronting protesters. What would it take to end weeks of civil unrest?
Also, lawmakers questioned leaders of the tech industry about their unregulated power.
I'm not concerned about others. I'm just asking you, Mr. Zuckerberg.
Democrats said they stifled competitors. Republicans said they stifled conservative voices. How did the corporate leaders respond? Stay with us. We'll guide you through this day's news. We now have confirmation that shutting down the U.S. economy for a good part of the second quarter was very bad for business. In truth, we knew that, of course, but a number from the government makes it clear just how bad. It's an estimate of economic growth, or the lack of it, in the second quarter, April, May, and June. You will recall that the country began shutting down in March and was pretty fully shut down, as close as it could be anyway, by April 1st. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley is with us. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What's the number you got?
It's the sharpest contraction in post-war history, Steve, 32.9%. Now, that's a little bit misleading. GDP numbers are usually reported in annual rates, as if the sharp contraction we saw in the second quarter was going to continue for a full year, and we don't expect that to happen. Nevertheless, it is about four times the worst quarter that we saw during the Great Recession more than a decade ago. Chief Economist Nariman Berevish of IHS Market calls this a horrific GDP number.
We've never seen anything quite like it.
Now, this was led by a sharp drop in consumer spending. As you mentioned, restaurants and retailers closed their doors in a desperate fight to slow the spread of the virus. As sharp as the downturn was, though, it was also very short. By the end of the quarter, we did begin to see a resumption of economic activity. But to be sure, that recovery is fragile and incomplete. Just this morning, we learned that another 1.4 million people applied for state unemployment benefits last week. That number was up slightly for the second week in a row. Claims for a special federal unemployment program for folks who ordinarily are not eligible were down a bit.
Well, that sets the stage for now. We are in the third quarter now, Scott. July, August, September. What do economists expect?
A lot depends on what happens with the pandemic, and some businesses are more vulnerable than others. Berevish described a kind of two-speed recovery, and you can hear that in some of the folks I've been talking with this week. Restaurant owner Cameron Mitchell, he likens this pandemic to a hurricane. He says what appeared to be a business rebound in June turned out to be only the eye of the storm, and now he's being buffeted again by gale force winds.
It's the most prolonged, difficult operating environment I've ever been a leader in. I've been in this business for 40 years.
Mitchell operates restaurants in 13 states, and he points to Florida as an example. His outlets there were almost back to normal in early June, but as infections took off, business dropped again. And that's true for a lot of businesses that depend on consumer traffic.
Well, which industries are doing well then?
Well, factories are picking up steam again. Construction crews are humming once more. So are dentists' offices, actually. About 450,000 people went back to work in dental offices in May and June. Yeah. Michigan hygienist Alexis Bailey says at first she was nervous about going back to work, but she got comfortable pretty quickly with the new safety precautions. And to her surprise, there was a lot of patients. The office has been book solid.
People miss getting their teeth clean. They want to catch up. And I think people, every time they come in, they say, this has been nice to get out of the house and, you know, feel safe and talk to somebody.
I get the impression, though, Scott, that people are still categorizing things as essential and non-essential. You got to get to the dentist eventually, but maybe you don't need to go out to the movies.
And you might be more willing to put up with some safety precautions in the dentist chair than you would be sitting at a fancy restaurant. We do know that that spending has dropped. That is keeping a lid on economic activity, and it was a decline in consumer spending that really led to that sharp contraction in the economy in the second quarter. It might have been even worse, though, were it not for the huge amount of federal spending and relief payments that went out. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said yesterday those $1,200 relief payments and the supplemental unemployment benefits have been an important lifeline keeping the economy afloat.
In a broad sense, it's been well spent. It's kept people in their homes. It's kept businesses in business. And that's all a good thing.
Now, of course, those supplemental unemployment benefits are expiring tomorrow, and Congress seems to be stuck as they try to figure out what kinds of additional support both families and businesses might need to keep the economy from sliding backwards again.
Scott, thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Steve.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. What happens now that federal agents are stepping back in Portland?
Right, that's the question. Now, as Oregon's governor says, these agents will come off the streets after many days of confrontations with protesters. Officers from various agencies were ordered to protect a federal building from protesters, but their actions appeared to intensify long-running protests over racial justice. Now the plan is for Oregon State Police to take over in hopes of de-escalating.
How's this supposed to work? Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, Steve.
What's the plan?
Well, under the deal, Oregon State Police will take over defending the federal courthouse. They say that they're going to work with federal law enforcement and the Portland police. The idea is to get federal law enforcement to leave while also ensuring the safety of the courthouse and those who work there.
Sure.
You know, these federal officers don't generally do crowd control. I mean, they've made some missteps that have really energized what prior to their arrival were some pretty small protests. I mean, at times, you know, fewer than 100 people. For instance, a U.S. Marshal shot a peaceful protester in the head with a crowd control device, putting the person in the hospital. And Oregon Public Broadcasting reported on Homeland Security officers in military-style uniforms using unmarked vehicles to arrest protesters. And, you know, all of this escalated what were fairly small protests into thousands of people we saw marching in recent days.
It also had people questioning the motives of the administration. What was the president doing? How did the administration end up agreeing to back off?
Well, this week, Governor Brown spoke with Vice President Mike Pence, and the governor pitched Pence on this plan. Pence got the Department of Homeland Security involved. There were a number of high-ranking officials in Portland this week, including the deputy director of the FBI, before this agreement came together and was announced yesterday.
I have to note that I heard first of this federal drawback from the state officials, from the governor. What are federal officials saying about what they will actually do?
Well, Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf says the surge of federal officers President Trump sent to Portland is going to stay and see how things unfold. Hmm. The difference is they're not going to be out there on the street unless state police can't protect the courthouse. Wolf pointed out in a news conference that many federal officers have been injured during the protests. The government has said that they have at least 114 federal officers guarding the courthouse. And in conversations my colleagues and I have had with law enforcement and the governor's staff, they say the idea is to return things to the normal level of federal law enforcement in the city.
Conrad, you've noted that the federal presence on the streets appeared to intensify the protests. Is it possible to see what might happen as they back off?
You know, this is really new. We don't know how protesters are going to react to this. I mean, that's been discussed conceptually. No one's seen it in action. And tonight is really, you know, we're going to see how this federal drawdown plays out.
And the administration has been playing up this kind of conflict, as we mentioned. I mean, do we know how this might change the rhetoric on either side?
Well, the Trump administration has put forward this narrative of Portland as a city under siege from protesters. I mean, Trump tweeted that if he hadn't deployed federal law enforcement, quote, there would be no Portland. It would be burned and beaten to the ground. In reality, the protests have mainly taken place in an area downtown. The vast majority of protesters have been peaceful and focused on racial injustice and police violence. The hope is that federal agents stepping back will de-escalate things and return things to the conversations between community police and the mayor.
Oregon Public Broadcasting's Conrad Wilson, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
All right, one of the lawmakers at a House hearing yesterday left no doubt how he views the tech industry. David Cicilline of Rhode Island referred to the American Revolution.
Our founders would not bow before a king, nor should we bow before the emperors of the online economy.
That is how the House Democrat referred to four tech CEOs who were on screens at the hearing: Amazon's Jeff Bezos, Apple's Tim Cook, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, and Google's Sundar Pichai spent almost 6 hours fielding questions. We just want to note here that all of these companies are among NPR's financial supporters.
NPR's Alina Selyuk was listening to the hours of questions with the reputed emperors of the economy. Hey there, Alina.
Good morning.
What'd you learn?
Right. So The House lawmakers who called the hearing have been investigating these companies for over a year now. So what we got was a bit of a first taste of what it is that they've learned from all the interviews and documents and emails that they've collected. The hearing was pretty adversarial, but in a way it was a tale of two hearings. One was the key focus, how these tech companies may have grown at the expense of others. For example, lawmakers grilled Facebook about how it buys or replicates rivals that threaten to lure away its users, like Instagram. Washington Democrat Pramila Jayapal read off emails between Zuckerberg and other executives.
Do you copy your competitors?
Congresswoman, we've certainly adapted features that others have let in, as have others copied and adapted features that...
I'm not concerned about others. I'm just asking you, Mr. Zuckerberg.
Similarly, Google has been accused by Yelp and others of stealing restaurant reviews and other content. Some small sellers on Amazon have complained about feeling trapped and dealing with confusing, ever-changing rules. App developers have accused Apple of unfairly charging them different fees. All four CEOs face different versions of the same question about how they throw their weight around to push competitors out of the way.
Well, you said this is a tale of two hearings. You've just described one. What was the other?
So the point of this hearing was how tech companies deal with competition, but a big chunk had nothing to do with that. Several Republicans, particularly the firebrand Jim Jordan from Ohio, probed the CEOs for anti-conservative bias.
Mr. Cook, is the cancel culture mob dangerous?
Jordan demanded neutrality from Google in the upcoming election and asked if all the CEOs supported diversity of opinions, which actually prompted a bit of an interesting moment. Bezos took a dig at discourse on social media, calling social networks nuanced destruction machines. I wish we could see Zuckerberg's face at that moment, but the video stream did not show him.
How much did the CEOs really have to say for themselves?
They had to say a lot, but they also rejected the premise of the hearing that they're being big bullies. They played up their humble beginnings, especially Bezos, the world's richest person. They highlighted how much people value their products and how they still face plenty of competition. Overall, the four CEOs essentially argued that any bad episodes were outliers and that their entire goal is to make their users, consumers, happy. And now we wait to see what the committee thinks when they release the final findings of their investigation.
Yeah, and they're talking of regulation here at some point. Lena, thank you very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Lena Selyukh. And that is up first for this Thursday, July 30th. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. We hope you start your day with us here tomorrow. You can subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you've got a few minutes, do us a favor, rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts.
When you're ready for more NPR news, we got a radio show for you, NPR's Morning Edition, which is on your NPR station. You can find the station at stations.npr.org. And for podcasts, local news, and the latest headlines, take NPR everywhere with the NPR One app, which is in your app store.
Until recently, Edmund Hong says he didn't speak out against racism because he was scared.
My parents told me not to speak up because they were scared. I'm tired of this.
Listen now on the Code Switch podcast from NPR.